I had the blessing, I think it was in 1992, someone here can correct me, of actually being at the last game played at Memorial Stadium in Baltimore. 91, thank you. I knew I could count on you. That was so over the top. It was literally like the game was completed. They start putting up on the Megatron, the one constant throughout all the years, Ray, has been baseball, if you're Field of Dreams fans. Soundtrack from The Natural. They literally like brought out these guns where they shot t-shirts into the crowd. And it was like every baseball player, every baseball fan's dream. They just threw baseballs out for people to catch for like 20 minutes. And it was this unbelievable spectacle and kind of, you know, the end of a space. We're not throwing out baseballs tonight. But I would be remiss if I didn't note that, as some of you may have seen, I posted online about, this is the last public lecture that is hopefully, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, happening in this space. And give it up. It's been 17 years we've been in this space. I think when we're in the new space, we'll have some more opportunity both to reflect on the new space, but also some of what's happened here. But there's been a lot that's happened in this space, and it is quite moving and emotional, even as we're so excited for the next stage. And at its best, this space has brought a lot of people together and has brought to the forefront a lot of creativity, a lot of new ideas, and the opportunity for people to think about how Jewish life might look different, might look more inspired, differently inspired. So I feel very privileged to be with all of you. And if it's okay for me to say, like, I think also you should feel lucky and fortunate that you're here at this special time. I hope you'll appreciate some of the things that I have to share this evening. But actually, really, more than that, I think this space has been home to an important moment in Jewish history, American Jewish history. We don't stand alone or in a unique space, but we have made our contribution in this space, and I and all of us should be very proud of it. I want to dedicate my thoughts tonight, which are going to be a little more in a, you know, I'm glad you talked about a mix of modes. Some of you have been to lectures where I have a prepared like 35-minute set of remarks that I read out with like crafting of each and every sentence, and others that are more interactive teaching, and there's going to be a little bit of a blend of some of those different modes tonight. But I want to dedicate these remarks to two people, groups of people. The first is to my stepfather, Senator Joe Lieberman, who passed away a few months ago, and whom one of the processes of Avelut for me has actually been coming to terms in a very good and powerful but unexpected way of the ways in which his approach to people, to politics, to communal life, actually had a profound impact on me more than I realized with respect to how I think about halacha. I will try to draw actually a couple of those connections for you as we go, but I miss him dearly, and these remarks are in part in his memory. The second dedication is to the many, many students who have come through this space, without whom the thoughts that I can offer and engage us on tonight just couldn't be. They wouldn't exist. I would not have had the opportunity to draft them out, make mistakes, learn things, teach the material from which I drew various kinds of insights, and who themselves represented the energy of being on a religious journey, which was why I bothered to be here day in, day out, in the first place. It's one thing to kind of have a dream of how you might teach Torah or what a space might look like. It's quite another thing to actually have people show up and participate in that and devote meaningful portions of their lives to that, whether that was people coming for a single lecture like tonight, people spending a whole week, as many in this room are, and for folks who have been here for a summer, for longer parts of an academic year, or lo aleinu, members of our current kollel who can't seem to leave. But they are on their way out. So to them and the inspiration that every generation gives to those who come before it, thank you. The last thing, which is really not an introduction, it's the beginning here, is to say a word about this metaphor of attunement. It's really actually the first time we're playing with this metaphor. And I'm saying we because we can't even remember who came up with it. I don't know if I did, Rav Aviva did, Rav Miriam Sima, but as we were talking about this, it was a metaphor that came up when thinking about halacha and specifically what I'm going to focus on this evening, which is the process of teaching halacha. Like my reflections this evening are really about what have I learned or what have I helped crystallize for myself about how I teach halacha and why I think that's important. And there are a lot of metaphors I've used around halacha in the past, but attunement is not one, actually, I have spent a lot of time with. And I'm finding it to be, and found it in preparing for this evening, resonant, catch that, resonant in all kinds of ways that I hope you will follow along as we kind of link back into it over and over. Right, simply put, submission, the sort of alternative here, is very much a metaphor of bearing a load or a weight that is outside of you, and you decide and build yourself up to do that work. But it's not actually clear anything about you changes other than you surviving and maybe becoming stronger. The metaphor of attunement suggests that what you're actually trying to do is get into a resonant frequency with something that is outside of you or starts outside of you, but that you are actually trying to be one with in some deeper way. And that's some of the theme that I want to pick up on this evening. The context for these remarks, as I said, is a lot of teaching in this space and in other spaces where I feel like a lot of these insights or commitments that I've developed have come to be. Some of those spaces, learning with my kids at home, studying texts from halacha with them, having them push me, feeling the responsibility of a father. How do I make this understandable? How do I transmit this? How do I leave room for their individual voice while trying to get them to understand that they're meant to be a reverential part of this tradition? The course that I taught here and have taught for many, many summers in particular and at other times during the year, usually it was just called Topics in Halacha, where there was basically a selection of different topics which we really weren't learning for the topic. We were learning by way of the topic to think methodologically in certain ways, to make certain assumptions. And then most recently, the teaching of halacha that I've done with our advanced kollel, which has been a whole other order of magnitude of demanding and expecting from people that they master a scope of canon beyond what you do in an individual session or in a week, and really make it their own. And what are the ways of teaching that are beyond helping someone learn something and master it, but to attune yourself to it? And so some of those are sort of the background pieces that have drawn me to that. Okay, with that, I want to lay out five insights or principles that will structure my remarks. For some of them, I'll teach a source or engage a source here and there. You've got the outline of the lecture on page one, and then we'll look at some of these other bits, some of which I have some translation, other of which I'm going to just take you through, and you'll hear it on the page. You'll hear it off the page, whether or not you're reading it on the page. First reflection on teaching halacha and what feels really important and what, on some level, is the most basic thing. But I feel like, A, we can miss it, and B, even if we value it, I'm not sure we always unpack why it's important, and I want to offer some reflections on why it's important. That first principle is what it is to teach halacha with careful reading and fluency. What it is to read things correctly and accurately, and the way in which that is actually an important spiritual practice. So, you know, the alternative here is to say, well, Does it matter so much if we read text precisely? What does it matter if we get the vocalization right? What does it mean if we parse the sentence right? If at the end of the day, I get the basic gist of what's going on, shouldn't that be enough? Sometimes we learn material in halakha, sometimes I teach material in halakha, in translation, in a way where I'm saying, all I care about here is that you get the idea. But when we're teaching something in a way that's actually about reading it in some way, to me, one of the most basic first things is that actually reading things correctly is part of a culture of respecting the author. If someone bothered to put down words on paper, if they bothered to use a certain language as the mode of expression, and if you have the ability to push yourself and to get that correct, that matters. On a fundamental level, actually, the respect for the text demands reading it over and over, parsing, not stopping until you've actually made sense of the way this line in the Tosafot leads into the next line of the Tosafot in a way that is challenging. It's some of the hardest work of learning is actually to discipline yourself to read correctly. But the recognition that this is not just respect for the text, but also that actually, I have seen this over and over, accuracy in reading is a portal to deeper understanding. I, in my own learning journey, I remember the times already decades ago where I feel like I was beginning to cross this threshold. There's a temptation at an earlier phase in learning to think, yeah, what matters is I get the idea and I understand it even though I don't really know how those two or three words come together. And over time, coming to confront the fact that when I was glossing over how those two to three words came together, I was actually glossing over the fact that I did not fully understand it, right? Actually, the practice of learning, insisting that our own imprecision of whether it's pronunciation, syntax, making clear sense of the words on the page is usually reflective of the fact that we have not fully understood something. And this leads to another point, which I think we maybe notice, but I'm not sure we always pay full attention to, which is that fluency, when we see people who are fluent in something, that usually commands respect. It commands other people's respect, and I put here in parentheses in my lecture notes, I think rightly commands respect. That is to say, when you see that someone has honed the craft of learning something with fluency, or they have the ability to speak something in a certain language, literary, legal, whatever it is, with a certain comfort, that draws out in us a sense that, oh, wow, that person actually seems to really know that. They seem to really understand that. They inspire confidence. And truth be told, what they're also seeing, I think, without realizing it, is that person clearly worked hard to get to the point where they're able to do that. And that effort indicates something profound about their learning. I want to here just turn to one text that I think draws this out in a kind of admittedly actually harsh context, but in a way that I think has an incredibly sort of soft and, to my mind, inspiring ending, and will give you also a feeling of some of what motivates me in my own teaching, quite frankly, of everything, but here thinking about halacha. So it's this text in Vayikra Rabbah. I'll read it out and render it for you in spontaneous translation. Rav Hanan de Tzipori. So Rav Hanan from Tzipori in the north of Israel. Patar kraya b'gmilut chasadim. The midrash here is talking about the phrase kishoshana ben achochim ken rayati ben abanot, like a lily among the thorns. It says in the Song of Songs, so is my beloved amongst the other maidens. So what we're imagining in the midrash, what is it like to be a lily among the thorns? Explained it in the context of gmilut chasadim, of being kind to other people. Now, we're about to read a text. It might not at all be clear to you how this is about being kind to other people. Banoag shebaolam, asara b'nei adam nichnasim levet ha'evel, ve'ein echad me'em yachol liftoach et piv, ulevarech birkat avelim. Ve'echad me'em poteach piv umevarech. Dome kishoshana ben hachochim. The normal thing is 10 people, the minimum quorum needed for this ritual, go into a house of mourning, and no one really knows how to comfortably say Birkat Avelim, the blessing for the mourners. Interestingly enough, this has kind of dropped out of practice. We don't really have this anymore, so there's an implicit coda to this story. But the idea is there is a ritual of something that seems it was said or a text, which very few people knew. So you would normally go into a room, and no one would know how to do it. But if someone did, if there was one person who had the fluency in that text and the memory of that text able to do that, they would be like a lily among the thorns. Now, just to insert this here, I think the sense in which this is about Gemilut Chasadim is you have mourners. There's actually something very powerful and moving to them that someone has entered into this space and is offering them this powerful ritual response in their moment of need. And if no one can do it, it's okay. But if someone can actually pull that off with confidence and fluency, wow. That's a lily among the thorns. We extend this. Banog sheba olam asara bnei adam nichnasim leveit haknesset ve'en echad mehem yachol lifros al shema ve'lavor lifnei ha'teiva ve'echad mehem yodea dome keshoshana ben achochim. Usually, the claim here is, you go into shul, no one knows how to lead davening. It's usually not someone, the average person is not comfortable to do that. If there's someone there who can step up and actually say, I know how to do this, and I feel confident to do it, that's like a lily among the thorns. And then we hear a story about one of the famous chachamim, Rabbi Elazar, Azal Lechad Atar. He went to one place. Amrule pros al shema. They said to him, can you lead the first part of the davening, where basically you start saying the shema for us? Amar lahen, Le na chacham. I don't know how to do that. Rabbi Elazar doesn't know really how to lead the Shema. Avor lifnei ha'teiva. Could you maybe lead the Amida for us? Amar lahem, le na chacham. I don't know how to do that. Amrin, they said, Dein hu Rabbi Elazar, Dein hu da'atun mit galgalin bay, al magen savchin le Rabbi. This is Rabbi Elazar. This is the guy everyone talks about. For nothing, they scream about him, oh, Rabbi, Rabbi. What's the matter with you? They basically insult him. Nitkarkemu panav, literally his face turns like saffron, goes yellow. Vehalach lo etzel Rabbi Akiva rabo. And he goes to his teacher, Rabbi Akiva. Amar le, lama panecha cholaniot? Why do you look so ill? Tani le uvda, he told him what happened. Amar le, tzave mare diyalif? Would you like to learn, says Rabbi Akiva? Would you like to learn how to lead davening? Amar le, in. Yes, actually, as a matter of fact, I would. Alfei, so he taught him. This is now like the scene in Superman 2, where Clark Kent comes back after, okay, if you know what I'm talking about. Levatar Yomin, a while later, Azal lehahu atra. He goes back to the same place. Amrule prosal shema. They say, lead the first part of davening. Paras, he did it. Avor lifnei teva, lead the Amida. Avar, he did it. Amrin, itchasem Rabbi Elazar. Oh, it must be that Rabbi Elazar had been muzzled, because now he's been released. Vekorin le Rabbi Elazar chisma. If you've ever encountered Rabbi Elazar Chisma, this is the etiology of his name. He was once sort of muzzled and then released. Rabbi Yona, we're now told at the end, Hava Malif Letalmidoi Birkat Avelim. He would make sure to teach all of his students the blessing for the mourners. Amar, he said, Yahavon Gavrin Bechol Mila. Literally, it means like, let them be men in every matter. But gavrin, also in the sense of like gibor, being masters of, I want them to be masters in all the skills. I want them to be able to show up in that house of mourning and be able to do whatever they need to do. Okay, there's a huge amount in this text. We could spend an entire evening on this text. We're not going to. What I find moving and meaningful about this text are any number of things. It's obviously a text that has some particular application to leadership and to a certain cadre of people who are expected to bear certain communal responsibilities. It's not per se a democratic text reflecting on what everyone's role or everyone's standard of knowledge is supposed to be. But what I find powerful about it is two things. One, it actually emphasizes that fluency, or the ability to know how to do things or to do them correctly or accurately, actually is to have a gift that you can give other people, something you can contribute to a community, to mourners in need, to a synagogue that's trying to pull together that kind of practice. And I would extend this to all teaching and all reading, including of halakha, the ability to give to someone in a clear way the sound of what a text is, the content of what that text is, and to be able to do it accurately is actually a gift that people are sometimes waiting for. And only by being serious about training and encouraging people to read in that way do we make that possible. And the ways in which both the fact that even the Rabbi Elazars of the world don't start out there, and that Rabbi Akiva's response, unlike the people in the community, is not to shame the person, but to say, would you like to learn? Because actually, I'm happy to sit down and teach you, but we're going to do it in a way that you will come out at the other end feeling extremely confident. That feels to me like a central motivating piece and a ground condition on some level for what it is to take anything seriously, but to take halakha seriously and to teach halakha seriously. So this first piece is, again, the notion that beyond just giving people experience of halakha, the notion that part of what we do is enabling people to understand things accurately feels central. And I think when you sit and really force yourself to read carefully, a number of times that I can't enumerate here, when students in this Beit Midrash have kind of refused to accept a reading that I offered because it didn't make sense to them, and through that stubbornness, which at the moment I was teaching it was extremely annoying, forced me to confront that they were actually considering a possibility I had not thought through, and I could give you any number of examples where it made me completely reread a text that we had been studying. That is the mirror image complementary component, right? Teachers insisting that their students read correctly, and students who insist that their teachers have to account for the things that are bothering them. Those are both aspects of careful reading, which are the number one piece of taking halakha seriously and what I've learned about teaching. Let's move to the second insight here, which is about multivocality and versatility. One of the things that I think has been, you know, a journey for me for years, and in many ways, I would say, my teacher and that of a number of others in the room, Rav Elisha Anshelovitz, was a really influential force in this way, is the understanding that there's just usually, basically always, more than one way to think about something. And there is basically, usually, always, more than one way to read something, okay? And the ways in which you have to embrace the idea that you might see a text in front of you, you may think it's completely clear what it means, but actually, upon further thought, there are definitely multiple ways to read it. I'll give you one example. It's a small example from something in the arena of halakha. It ends up having very significant implications, l'ma'aseh. Short sugya in Masechet Ketubot, it's dealing with the question of what kinds of things can you do on Shabbat for someone who's not feeling well? We know, of course, you violate Shabbat in the most dramatic way for someone whose life is on the line. And we also know that if someone's just feeling meh, you don't violate Shabbat for that. But if someone's like, they're really not feeling well, they have a fever, they can't easily get out of bed, what are you allowed to do? There's a lot of different and conflicting sources around that. But one of them is this. We have a tradition where Rabbi Marinos says, someone suffering from a heart condition, goneach, someone who's moaning, but it's understood to be it's angina or some other condition that's leading them to this state, can suckle from an animal to get fresh milk on Shabbat. Okay, this seems to be the idea of like fresh hot milk seems to have been the remedy here. This is, you know, if you think our cough medicines are so much more reliable than this, there's a lawsuit percolating now against Sudafed and other companies that none of their products actually do anything. So before you snicker, this might be actually as good. In any event, this hot milk is meant to make you feel better. However, you can't milk an animal on Shabbat, all right? But you are allowed, says Rabbi Marinos, to directly suckle from an animal on Shabbat. The Gemara says, why? How does that work? Well, someone who suckles from the animal is mifarek kila achar yad. It's not really the milacha of mifarek, separating one thing out from the other, which is the category under which milking an animal would fall. It's just a rabbinically forbidden action. Okay? In other words, nursing is not a milacha. Suckling is not a milacha. Sure, if you did the same thing with your hands, that would be a biblical prohibition. This is only a rabbinic prohibition. Uvimakom tzara lo gazru rabbanan. The rabbis didn't extend their prohibitions in cases of pain. And then the sugya ends that the halacha follows this view. So a simple, straightforward reading, which is what the overwhelming majority of poskim, how they read this text, is, so we learn from this, that it's permitted to violate rabbinic restrictions on Shabbat, at least if they're done in a backhanded way, for those who are in some kind of full body pain. A Jew can never violate Shabbat to ease someone's pain when their life is not at risk, so you can't do anything that is a biblical prohibition. It happens to be that this is a rabbinic prohibition, so you can do it at least with some kind of shinui. And this produces a pretty mainline psak, which most people are familiar with, which is like, well, if it's a biblical prohibition, like maybe you have to involve a non-Jew in the process, maybe that could work out, but you can't do anything yourself that's going anywhere near a biblical prohibition, and receives confirmation from this text, we only allow it because it is an isur de rabbanan. When we were learning in the Kolel Hilchot Shabbat, remember we got to this point, and everyone was like sort of frustrated or questioning, like, okay, but like, what if you have like a situation where there's no one who's not Jewish around and like you have to do something involving a biblical prohibition that really you're just going to let them suffer because they won't die? Or is that the only way? How could that be that that's the only way the poskim thought about this? I said, okay, just wait a minute. Let's look at the Torat HaAdam. And the Torat HaAdam by the Ramban says, no. Read that text a completely different way. When the text said, Mifarek kila achar yad hu, yonek is nursing, suckling from the animal, is a case of, it's not a milacha, because it is done kila achar yad, it's done in a backhanded way. That doesn't mean that the action is rabbinic. It means the action is a biblical violation, but you're doing it in an unusual way. It's not rabbinic because it's intrinsically rabbinic. It's rabbinic because when you do a biblical action in an unusual way, it becomes a rabbinic prohibition. And then the sages do not forbid it. Mipnei she'ein na'asin b'shinui shelo kederech hamelachot. Because this is being done in an unusual way, it no longer gets classified as being something biblical. You reread it that way, you say, it's permitted for Jews to perform a milacha on Shabbat in an unusual way in order to relieve full body pain. Now, I remember I picked this example, not because it's the only or even best example, but I remember very specifically, actually, when teaching the Kolel Shiur on this topic, one student in particular in the Shiur being like, I can't believe the Ramban just said that. Or I never would have imagined reading the Gemara that way. That completely reoriented my perspective, right, on how it could have been read. Now, maybe you intuitively already came to the Ramban's reading, but to me it was a reminder of another central element whenever we're learning halacha, right? The multivocality pieces, never assume that you have already seen or thought through all the readings of the text. It's just not actually how it works. And there is a sort of shocking range of positions in this corpus. Now, years ago, when I was an undergraduate, I took a course with Professor Ken Shepsley. He was in the government department at Harvard. And he had authored an article which was called "Congress is a They, Not an It." The colon was then "The Fallacy of Legislative Intent," which was a very interesting whole argument about, is there ever such a thing of talking about a law having a meaning, given that when you know that actually 100 or 435 people have to vote on something, like, what did they possibly all agree? But Congress is a they, not an it. I have thought about frequently in the parallel, Chazal is a they, not an it, right? One of the most important things in learning and teaching halakha is remembering what the Talmud screams out to you on every single page. Rabbi Ploni said X. Rabbi Ploni said Y. We are naming people. They disagree. They are not a flattened corpus. So we all, when we teach things or when we write brief articles, have to say things like, the Talmud says. But there's nothing quite as insulting to the Talmud as saying the Talmud says. Okay? And the idea that you would gloss over the very thing that makes this document, this whole oeuvre, distinctive, is something I think we always have to be on guard for, right? Are you listening to all the voices? The range of positions is often astoundingly broad. This starts in the Talmud itself, but I'll extend it further, right? The poskim are a they, not an it. The entire corpus of halakha, if you just allow yourself to listen to it, is screaming out that there are multiple voices saying different things. You actually have to do a tremendous amount of work to turn halakha into something where you would say, the halakha says that. There's just almost nothing like that. You can say the halakha says you can't do melacha on Shabbat. That's true until we try to start defining melacha. Okay? But other than that, right, the entire dynamic is that way. There are certainly, like any good logical system proven from Gödel on forward, there is an incompleteness to halakha, meaning what? Not everything that's true can be proved in any given logical system. That's what Kurt Gödel proved in his famous incompleteness theorem. It's also true that halakha cannot articulate everything that is important in Judaism or that needs to be said. But with that caveat, we are talking about a language with an unbelievable versatility in terms of what can be said. And the second thing that has emerged only stronger and stronger for me over the years as a teacher of halakha is to try to impress this on all of us, onto my students. You do not understand this thing until you are always looking for the third and fourth and fifth opinion on any given topic. And for those of us who spent time in the halakha intensive this week, when you really understand halakha is when you see the Ra'ah and the Rashba going head to head and neither one of them is giving the other an inch. That's when you will truly understand the oeuvre you are studying, not when you've decided the Rashba comes out on top. Which goes to the next piece here, which is what it means to build up a discourse and a disposition around halakha that is about accountability as opposed to about obedience. Incidentally, let me say one more thing about the multivocality. I'm not going to take you through, I gave you one example, like the defilement of Kohanim in our day, which is a topic I taught here in Topics in Halakha year after year, an amazing example of just the range of the different Rishonim, the positions that they stake out, really underscores this. But this also, to me, is the core meaning of the statement in the Gemara, in the name of Rav, Ein moshivin basanedrin ela misha yodea letaheret hasheretz mina Torah. You cannot put someone on the Sanhedrin who can't find a way to prove that a sheretz, the ultimate case of being defiled, is actually pure. And I just want to stake out a reading on this text, okay? There are people, including some mentors of mine, who have read this text as affirming awareness of a basic legal nihilism at the root of the system. That is to say, you can read this text as saying, you want to understand what halakha is about, anyone who's clever enough can actually come up with the most preposterous arguments that will get you to the exact opposite of the truth. And unless someone is a true legal nihilist in understanding that, and they've engaged in the craft of that kind of legal nihilism of purifying the sherets, well, then they can't be trusted with the authority of the Sanhedrin, because actually all there is to the system is its authority. The legal argumentation at the end of the day is just there to be manipulated by the brightest and most clever minds. But in reality, it's the authority that determines what's going on. So unless you have someone who understands that, they can't sit on the Sanhedrin. I think that's totally upside down. I think this text actually recognizes that at the root of serious halachic discourse is the ability to offer readings and possibilities that are the exact opposite of what you expected. You do so in a way that is thorough, that is actually playing out some kind of discourse. Sure, you could take it too far and be matayra sheretz, but actually what you need on the Sanhedrin is someone who understands in a deep way that the surface reading of any given text is never the final word on what that text means. And without understanding that, that person cannot be entrusted with that piece. So that goes to the sort of versatility of the system and its importance. Okay, going back now to accountability as opposed to obedience. One of the things I think I always had an allergy to, but I think just over time of teaching in this space, I really cultivated a sense of conviction around that allergy, was whenever, I feel like even starting in high school, it's like you would encounter some interesting position, some interesting take in halakha, and then you would inevitably get the response, but we don't paskin that way. We don't, that's not what we follow. And almost rendering halakha a kind of series of votes of which positions remain and which get voted off the island. And that's the sort of authoritative rabbinic version of that. The version of it that can come from a student of text is, I don't like that view. That view is threatening to me. I don't want to go to that view's conclusion. I will find a way to marginalize or eliminate that view. Great. That source is saying something I don't want. I found 5 sources that say the opposite. I'm going with those. Or the little dicier version, those 5 sources are saying something I don't like. I found this one, and I'm going to rely on that one. It's good enough. Right? But all of that is actually just voting up or down one way or the other on positions that we either like or don't like. Now, the problem with voting things up or down is twofold, right? One, on a sort of intellectual, spiritual plane, you have ignored whatever wisdom is in those other sources, right? You've actually failed in any way to account for what they're talking about. On a strategic level, I would also say the suppression of those views tends to simply make them come back in other forms, having been unaddressed, with greater threat to you, to the system that you're trying to protect from them. And therefore, the much healthier way and the much stabler and kind of meaning-infused way to engage the multivocality of halakha, I would even say on some level this almost inevitably flows from multivocality, is to cultivate the language and the method of accountability to sources. Instead of asking, do I agree with this source? Do I disagree with that source? Instead, take for granted that you're accountable to all of them. And then figure out, okay, how would I figure out how to account for all of them? If you look on the back, you can see an example of a million. We're not going to go through it. My students have suffered through many of these. What I will call halakha accountability charts. We find a debate between two authorities There's four sources in the Gemara that have to be dealt with by anyone who wants to take the canon seriously. Explain to me how each person deals with each of the sources. Sometimes the poskim take you through this mahalach, but a lot of times they do not, right? Here is a debate between Rambam and Yireim as to whether basically you need, on a biblical level, to show honor to your parents when they are sinners. If your parent is broadly defined wicked, does the mitzvah of kibud av va'em actually get held in abeyance or canceled, or does it remain in effect? And the problem is there's four sources in the Gemara that more or less break down two and two, pushing in the opposite directions. So you could come to this. By the way, let me add, for very good and understandable personal and emotional reasons, with an answer that you want. If wickedness includes, I don't know, not publicly observing Shabbat, and you have a parent who falls in that category, and you are deeply attached to the notion that that in no way compromises your respect or honor for them, well, then you're going to be a friend of the Rambam in this debate, and you're going to be running away from the Yireim. And that's totally understandable. By contrast, you have a parent who is wicked in the sense that they were emotionally abusive to you, or worse, and you actually desperately need a narrative where you are released from the obligation to honor them, well, the Rambam's going to be very threatening to you, because the Rambam, at the end of the day, insists that kibud av va'em is kind of like a biological fact that doesn't go anywhere. And the Yireim is going to be your friend because he's going to have the language of talking about how that whole obligation is circumscribed by a certain decency of behavior that your parent may be failing. But as much as that's understandable, that you would go in that direction, you will, in the ways I said, be losing the wisdom, certainly as a student of halakha, if we're talking about someone who's trying to learn this and maybe teach it to others, you will lose the wisdom of what is on the other side of that balance, if only needed to talk to different people with different circumstances and different needs. But also, more broadly, you will sit unstable in your conviction that you have actually reached the right conclusion, unless you can do some version of this chart where you can fill out, again, I'm not taking you through the exercise, you can fill out, I can explain how I am 100% faithful to all aspects of the canon, and nonetheless, I have reached this answer. This notion of accountability as a fundamental exercise and practice in teaching and learning halakha, as opposed to obedience, where I'm just following and then I'm picking which parts I'm going to follow or turn the volume up or down on. What accountability actually does is it restores your agency. You are actually called upon and able, if you are learned and committed enough, to make up that chart, and you will be a wiser person for it. Fourth insight. History matters. The notion we just did, some of us earlier, a map of the Rishonim exercise, and playing out the ways in which intellectual connections can give us a fuller picture of who's doing what. But there are certain halachot I actually think you simply cannot understand if you do not understand who is whose teacher and where is someone located geographically and what intellectual tradition are they a part of. I'll just give you one example. On the bottom of page 3, another text that I've taught many times in this space. This is a text dealing with Bishulei Nochrim, with the category of the prohibition of Jews eating foods that were cooked and prepared by Gentiles, irrespective of whether there's anything wrong with the ingredients from a kashrut perspective, one of a number of regulations that emerge in the rabbinic period and earlier, managing separation, division, distinction between Jews and others. And one of the basic requirements is some Jewish involvement in the cooking can neutralize this concern and this problem. So the Shulchan Aruch begins by saying that meaningful participation in the cooking means that you have to actually place the food that you're cooking in the oven. You can't just like throw something into the fire or rake the coals or do anything like that. For the Shulchan Aruch and for Sfaradi practice until today, if you want something to be considered food that has been cooked by Jews, you will have to actually place that food that you're cooking in the oven. And then the Rama at the end here glosses and says, well, some people think it's actually enough to rake the coals. And other people think, as long as the fire that's being used to cook the food was lit by some other flame, from some other flame, which was originally lit by a Jew, the whole problem goes away. And you find, right, this comes out in contemporary Ashkenazi mashgiach practice. All the mashgiach has to do in order to address this problem is to go into the kitchen at some point, turn the oven on. In the old days where there used to be a pilot light, most things are electronic ignition now, the mashgiach comes in, blows out the pilot light, relights it, that's it. That gas stove is a bishulei goyim free zone, and you never have to worry about it again. Now, that ruling on its own seems kind of insane. It seems tendentiously lenient. It seems over the top. It seems to fall out of the sky. And okay, you'll follow it if you want to be lenient, but if you just consider it a flat sock that is not anchored in any time and space, I think it will and should puzzle you. But if you start paying attention to history and to geography, you will learn that, well, actually, this ruling from the Rama hails from the Maharam Mirotenberg, who's one of the great late medieval German authorities. He's the one who issues this ruling. And if you go back earlier in time and study the practice of Bishulei Nochrim in Germany, you will find that people earlier than the Maharam Mirotenberg essentially argue that the category is just an extension of kashrut and fear of people mucking with the ingredients. It's actually not encoding a difference between Jews and Gentiles at all. It's just a fear of people who don't keep kosher potentially ending up putting things that are non-kosher in your food. And if you then have a society, which the Maharam and others seem to have had, where actually there are some pretty clear lines between Jewish and Christian homes, and unless people are converting one to the other, they're not having a kind of free-flowing association with one another, you then start to realize, oh, this is a technical psak because it comes from a German tradition where they are not substantively concerned about Bishulei Nochrim. That kind of insight and therefore, to my mind, deeper respect and appreciation for the halakha can only come from learning that context. That's one piece of what it is to take history and context seriously. The other piece is learning to listen for silence in halakha, which you can only do when you are attuned to intellectual history. So again, for those who just did our map of the Rishonim exercise, one of the deepest things you come to understand if you pay attention to how the ideas of halakha flowed from one to the other is that the creativity of the Baalei HaTosafot in France in the Middle Ages happens in a essentially hermetically sealed off environment from the world of the Rambam and his codification of halakha. And so, for instance, anything that is an innovative point that starts in the world of the Baalei HaTosafot, you basically know, if you understand intellectual history, that the Rambam could not have held that position. And that if you look carefully in the Rambam, you will maybe see hints of the fact that he didn't, but more to the point, you will hear in his silence the fact that he must not have even entertained this being an issue. So this comes up, one of the most prominent places where this comes up, where you already see classical poskim understanding it, in the context of Hilchot Nida, in the laws of Nida and questions of bidikot, questions of checking the menstruating body for whether it has ceased to menstruate and whether the time now for either counting days or immersion has arrived. There's an entire set of assumptions in the Shulchan Aruch, tracing from the Rashba, that there's a whole strict regime around those kinds of bidikot that are absolutely essential for a husband and wife to resume relations after menstruation. If you're aware of history and intellectual history, the second I say stems from the Rashba, and you know that the Rashba actually is already in later medieval Spain, so that should shoot up your antennae to wonder, wait a minute, why did no one before the Rashba say that? And maybe the people who are silent prior to the Rashba, even though they never weighed in on this question, they are actually silent witnesses for the opposition. In this case, the Noda Biyuda, in his She'elot u'Tshuvot, explicitly, it's an amazing situation where you watch him come to this realization. He says, you know, I was dealing with this whole area of Halakha. Then I opened up the Rif. I opened up the Rambam. There's nothing there on this topic. I guess they don't have the laws of Bidikot outside the world of Taharot, world of purity, but not in the world of intimate relationships with a couple. And Oda doesn't go the full distance of therefore dismantling the whole thing, but that becomes a major energy in the system for rerouting the entire discussion. Why was he able to do that? Only because he listened to silence, right? One danger is we don't paskin that way, which is you shut down things that you hear. Another danger is, I don't know, no one ever said anything to the contrary, so everyone must agree. Actually listening to the fact that taking halachic innovation seriously also has as a corollary recognizing that it has an origin, date, and place, and that place is beyond the reach or prior to that origin, date, and place actually have to be factored in. The last piece. Halachic texts at the end of the day are about something. I can't prove this to you in 5 minutes. I'm not sure I can prove it to you at all. It's a little bit of an assertion that halachic texts are not just arbitrary guidelines, if you're asking me, right, my orientation to teaching it. These are not arbitrary guidelines for a certain kind of behavioralism or a discipline. Well, I'll quote one text, which I didn't put on the source sheet, which is another text that I think is misread. Vayikra Rabba famously says, "V'chichpat lo laKadosh Baruch Hu im ani shochet min haOref o min haTzavar." Does God care if you slaughter an animal from behind or from in front? Of course, an animal slaughtered in front is kosher. An animal slaughtered from behind is treif. Does God really care? Rav says, "Lo nitnu mitzvot ela letzaref b'hen atabriot." The mitzvot were just given to, my translation will already point us in a direction, but let's just say in a neutral way, to refine human beings, to refine people. And one way that that text is read is, you see, this is rabbinic sources saying, none of this really matters. God doesn't care if it's from behind or from in front. They're just giving you rules to make you live a disciplined life. Right? In other words, to refine people by having things, maybe sometimes even helpful, if they're arbitrary things, that will make them not just do whatever they feel like. I think we might have heard this one from Rabbi Elisha years ago, the forceful retort to this, which is, you're totally reading the sentence wrong. V'chi ichpat lo lehakadosh baruch hu. Do you think God cares whether it's from behind or in front? No, these mitzvot are for you. And for you, it makes a big difference whether it's behind or in front. Why? The way a predator kills its prey is from behind. If you ever watch those great Animal Planet videos, right? They're going up and they're grabbing it by the neck, and that's how you kill something. When you kill something from the front, it's one of the most powerful instantiations of the idea of, oh, I'm not a predator. I'm someone authorized to take a human tool, which I'm going to wield in a non-predatory way in order to avail myself of this meat, and then I'm going to spill the blood on the ground, and everything I do is going to pull me away from that. And the entire point of that text is, you think this is about some arbitrary service of God? This is about making you a better person. That's what the mitzvot are about, okay? I can't prove to you that reading, but I have a bias towards that reading, and that reading says halacha is about something. It is actually about making choices between all kinds of values to give us a more directed, moral, better, more elevated life. What it also means to take that into account, that mitzvot are about religious meaning and that halakha is about religious meaning, is to also pay attention to the ways in which people make choices between various shitot in halakha. Sometimes there's rules, conventional rules. Oh, we follow Rav when it's Rav and Shmuel in Isurei. We follow Shmuel when it's Rav and Shmuel in monetary matters. And sometimes 17 people said this and 3 people said that, and so you have to find a way to go to it. But at the end of the day, when a community sticks with a practice for hundreds of years, when there are other options on the books, that too, in a certain fundamental way, means it is bringing some kind of stable and ongoing meaning to their life, which is the reason they are sticking with it. There are too many zigzags in the history of halakha. Communities sometimes shifting practice, pulling back old precedents to use as a basis. Every communal decision has to actually be understood as encoding some kind of value payoff or tone. And the last thing, which to me is the most important, and it's hard to do, I feel like it's ongoing work for me, is the idea of mitzvot insisting that at the end of the day, halakha is actually not just a theoretical exercise, but it meets people in their lives where they are. If you're serious about mitzvot actually being lived, the discourse of halakha and its and our decisions around it are actually going to affect people and are actually going to translate in real ways in their lives. And when we teach it, we always have to think about that. Remembering that something's going to affect people's lives does not mean, let me come up with the interpretation that will be the easiest for them, the least painful, the thing that they want. Sometimes halakha is actually a challenging, countercultural force and is meant to upend certain things about your life. But at the end of the day, you have to be accountable to the fact that if you are asking something to be countercultural, well, you're a little bit on the hook for what is the effect that that's happening on people's lives. Yeah, and I'll take a couple so we can just get a few voices out here.
So I wonder whether, regarding point E, you've perhaps been a bit unfair to the position that mitzvot are othership. And this is for two reasons. Firstly, there are texts you haven't mentioned that seem to suggest this, such as, for example, mitzvot lav lehanoshim nivnu, or Rabbi Hanani ben Akashi Omer, Rosh HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Zekot Yisraeli, Tifath Yerbal HaMtara mitzvot, or as another example, the person who says in davening al kana tzipor yagia rachamecha is supposed to be removed because, and the one of the explanations...
Einan elak zeirot.
Right, einan elak zeirot. So in the spirit of your point C, accountability to all the sources, how do you against the view that...
Excellent.
...arbitrary, hold yourself accountable to the sources. But then secondly, I'm not sure that the view that mitzvot are arbitrary has to be religiously meaningless. Think about, for example, the Maharal of Prague, who manages to make this view, I think, religiously meaningful by saying, by giving us these arbitrary commands and prohibitions that have no natural explanation, God takes us out of nature. I'll stop there.
Great. Excellent. Other questions? Yeah, Arya.
You know, I've spent the same years that you have also, in my different contexts, in some same context, hammering a lot of these points, and particularly point A, about the importance of precision, fluency, scholarship. And I'm also wondering what we need to do to uncover the friction between point A and point B. That a lot of the social conditions that lead to fluency are the same social conditions that narrow one's scope, one's horizons, and shut one out from a lot of wisdom that happens on the margin.
Great, great. Yeah, take two more.
So, something I've been struggling with that I think addresses your points is one of the things that I came to the conclusion of, when you're reading halakhic sources, one of the things that these some of these rabbis, not all of them, some of them were more ivory tower, but some of them had something that we don't have now, and I'm glad we don't have, want to preface that, is enforcing authority. When Shulchan Aruch says chayav, it means there could be social sanctions to the person who didn't feel the obligation. You know, and we don't feel it at a very strict level of, you know, everyone really enforcing it, but we don't even feel it like in our own families. Like, we don't want to enforce the halacha on our children. Like, I mean, and how does halacha change when reading these texts in the context of, we're trying to figure out what the wisdom, what's the right thing to do is, when they understood it as a socially enforceable construct, and how, sometimes I struggle with how whether that has any impact or what the impact should be.
Yeah, great. Take one more, yeah.
Is this sort of accountability to multiple voices itself an innovation with the history? And if so, kind of like, where does it come from? Because it seems that when we were discussing, like, Rishonim, Rashba doesn't give an inch, and like, Rambam, Paskin from on high, and they all seem, the multiple voices all seem themselves univocal.
Great. Okay, let me actually start with that one. Look, there's no question that the accountability to multiple voices is always a little bit of a function of, are they sufficiently in your rearview mirror that you don't feel they're your peers, right? In other words, it's rare that people with their peers feel like, well, I'm totally accountable to this person who is opposite me in the same place and time and making what I think is the wrong decision. Now, even there, I want to come back to in answering your question, like, I would put an asterisk on that too, and that I think serious learning does that as well. And I don't know always that, like, the battle royale between the Maor and the Ramban, the Rashba and the Ra'ah, those are awesome and exhilarating to learn. They're not, like, for the most part, the mode, like, that this Beit Midrash operates on, right, of encouraging people to have a fight to the death over their, you know, warring interpretations. Not, you know, sometimes those intense fights are actually very generative, and I worry sometimes if we don't have them at all. But there is an element there of, within reason, sure. The people that you feel are like beyond your reach, right, are in the past. And we actually had that in one source we learned today where Rabbi Ovadia Yosef is trying to explain, like, why isn't the, you know, the Rivash taking account of, you know, this person who's disagreeing with him? And he's like, because he just thinks he's wrong. So he's not going to, like, we who are looking back on the Rivash and Rabbeinu Tam are like, I don't know how to make that decision. But he was like, I know how to make that decision, and I'm right. And that's clearly a little bit of a function of time and distance. And even there, I would say to you, for sure, even if I feel motivated to have to find what's the kernel of truth and insight in what any student, beginning student in topics in halacha class I may have in the summer will raise and genuinely feel that and have learned so much from that, yes, there is still a difference between being up against a peer and someone who you feel is like anchoring the system on some level without which you don't feel you can move authentically. But I think that's right, right? It's not completely neutral across all the times and places. Yeah, as opposed to whether A and B are in conflict, yeah, I hear that. I think my instinct, but it has to be fleshed out more, is I think there is and can be a difference. I'll give two parts answer. One, I think there is a difference between precision and expertise. That is to say, expertise is not always great. Precision, I generally feel, is better than imprecision, right? And the challenge then becomes, can you force someone, push someone who does not have expertise to be more precise in their articulation of something? In particular, if you're a teacher, a more experienced learner of halakha, we've talked about this a lot, can you help them translate their insight into, yeah, I get what you're saying now, this is what the Rashba is saying, right, in this context. And that's where you can bring someone in. That's the sort of piece one. Piece two, which is, I think, beyond what I can opine on, but I hear the question, implicitly, it's like, do you need a certain kind of authoritarian regime to get people to learn with a certain degree of precision? There, too, like, maybe, I don't know, you can ask my students, like, you could ask the people in the Kollel, how authoritarian have I been, right, in certain modes? And truth is, Some of the time, probably, yeah, a little bit. Or speaking as a father with kids, it's like, sometimes I'm demanding about certain things, hopefully not to the breaking point, that can they have corollary effects of, I didn't feel like I had the space, right, to sort of think this through? It's a real question, right? And I think my instinct on that is, I'm reflecting on what are some of the things that feel important about teaching halakha, but that is not a reflection on what is the ecosystem of different kinds of spaces that we need. I actually think, I mean, I made this as a passing comment, but I'll say it again. Like, I think overall the environment, again, you've got to ask students, but overall the environment at Yeshivat Adar is not an overly combative environment. For the most part, I think that is positive. I think it would probably be good if the larger ecosystem also had an egalitarian Beit Midrash where people were like going at it in the most intense way, and that would not be the right place for everyone. And then the question is, how do you draw out all those different voices? I don't know. That feels like an ongoing question, but I really appreciate the insight. Yeah, the question of consequences, I think the only response I would have to that is, you might in some times and places be overplaying what the consequences were. Here I'm always brought back to, I love this comment of Shia Cohen, where he says, we have a great affinity for the ancient rabbis because we live in a post-rabbinic world and they lived in a pre-rabbinic world. And I'm like, how could that be? But his point is they don't yet have the authority and the consolidation of the Middle Ages and Jewish rabbis being given, you know, state power by the hegemons, et cetera. And actually, in a way, I think if you take Chazal seriously in the environment, which and someone may have the ability to put someone in cherem, the way we can also kick someone out of a shul, right? But for the most part, they're living also in a largely unenforceable world. And there, the sources for how we learn to think of this way, right, at all. So I do not deny that the question of whether there are consequences or not is a significant question in terms of how this plays out, but I'm not sure we're alone in the low consequence end of things in the spectrum of rabbinic history. All right, last bit for your wonderfully learned and challenging question, Avi, in terms of, you know, accountability all sorts of. So first of all, yes, cosine. I and everyone else is accountable to all those sources, right? You need to actually find a way that you are playing. You got to draw that chart. I can give you a couple thoughts about it. When you ask generally, like, can discipline on its own be meaningful, right? In other words, can you have meaningless mitzvot on some level whose meaning is in following them, right? And the Einan Ela Gzerot, right? A theory of mitzvot that goes too far in the direction of, oh, everything is in order to achieve this value and that value. Can that hit a wall? I have no problem accepting that in principle, right? The idea that there are certain ways that you do things that have a certain arbitrariness to them, and they are in the category of things that you do for a spouse, for a loved one who asks you to do things that you really don't understand or don't value or think are a waste of time, but it's important to them, and they ask you to do them, and you do it as part of the relationship, right? For me, and you may have heard me say this before, for me, the line is whether that kind of disciplinary regime is taming your id as opposed to overriding your superego. If it is about bringing some discipline to a life that would otherwise be unruly with no guidelines and you're just giving someone some structure, I can accept some degree of that in the system. I'll always be suspicious, is that really what the mitzvah was originally about? When you hear a source saying, oh, this is totally arbitrary, is that just saying, today this is arbitrary? Is it a claim it was always arbitrary? I always want to ask those questions. But when you get to a point where the arbitrariness of halakha is meant to actually stand in an overriding position to any sense of morality, ethics, thoughtfulness, a sense of moving as a purpose-driven person in the world, that starts to feel like it just contradicts a whole bunch of things that the Torah Shebichtav says black on white, Letovlach, this is for you, it's going to be better, etc., and the way in general it seems Torah Shabbat Peh works. But the exercise of the accountability chart for all the texts that you raised has to be left for after our time here.